Welcome. I'd like to bring up an old Zen story today about one of our Chinese ancestors. Our ancestor Dongshan lived in the 9th century in China. In Japanese, we call him Tozan Liokai. And the toe of his name is the toe of Soto Zen. So this is our particular lineage ancestor, named after this ancestor. We have a big toe in our lineage. So, because he's one of our personal ancestors, I think this story nicely illustrates the style and understanding of our particular lineage of practice. The story goes like this. Dongshan was walking along one day with his Dharma brother, his friend Sung Mi, going for a hike, and on the forest path, suddenly a white rabbit leaped across the path in front of them. And Sung Mi said, "Whew, that was quick. Swift." And as often the case in these old Zen stories, these Dharma friends were looking for any excuse to have a kind of Dharma conversation. So, you know, rabbits leaping across paths and things like this, they use it as an opportunity. So, to kind of bring out their understanding together. So some of you might have heard that Zen is considered a sudden school, a swift path to awakening. Traditionally in Buddhism, there's a path where you gradually develop your conduct and your concentration and your understanding over a long time, maybe infinite eons of lifetimes, sometimes it's said, to realize Buddhahood. But Zen, from the get-go, is this particular understanding and style of practice that points directly to our true nature. So it doesn't have to take a long time. It's very like direct path. In early Zen there was this issue about sudden and gradual, but by the time of these ancestors, Dongshan and Sung Mi, all the Zen in China was considered the sudden school of Zen. So, a rabbit quickly leaping across the path provided a nice opportunity to talk about what do we mean by swift or sudden. So these two friends are walking along, the rabbit leaps across the path, and Sung Mi says, "Quick, swift." And Dongshan says, "How so?" That's how they start the conversation. "What do you mean?" And Sung Mi says, "It's like an ordinary commoner instantly promoted the prime minister." the image for sudden realization of the exalted status of prime minister as just an ordinary commoner, instantly. And Dongshan said to Sunmi, such a venerable long-term practitioner like you, and you still talk that way? Kind of, you know, it's his friend, but he's kind of critiquing his understanding a little bit. And Sunmi says, well, how would you say it, brother? And Dongshan says, after generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty. So, another understanding of sudden realization. This is the more the understanding of our particular Soto lineage, because Tozan expressed this swiftness in an unusual way after generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty, or after a long, long time, after beginningless time, as complete nobility with all the power and wealth that comes with being a king or a queen. Naturally, that way, from beginningless time, we've temporarily fallen into this kind of state of poverty. It's kind of like the reverse, right, of a commoner being instantly promoted to prime minister. I've heard this modern saying, I don't know where this came from, but I think it's a modern version of this story, actually. Something like, it's not so much that we are human beings that have temporary spiritual experiences. It's really that we're spiritual beings having a temporary human experience. That's another version of this, the two images in this story. See how that's so? And probably it's the case that Dongshan is bringing up this image of after generations of nobility temporarily falling into poverty. I think he's referring to a story in the Lotus Sutra. There's many parables in this amazing sutra that was it's very dear to the hearts of Zen ancestors. The Lotus Sutra, many beautiful parables. This may be my favorite one. And to comment on this story, I think it's nice to hear, to comment on this Zen dialogue, it's nice to hear the Lotus Sutra story. So, in the sutra, once upon a time, there was this king who, a noble king, wealthy, generous, and lived in a beautiful place and ruled the land, you could say. And he just had this only child, this one son. And one day when the son was very young, He ran away from home, the sutra says. You know, like, if he was really too young to even remember where he lived and run away from home, it's maybe unusual. Maybe we could also think of it as I could picture the story being more like, he was out with his parents in a busy marketplace and he got lost. He wandered off in a really busy Indian marketplace and lost his parents in a huge city and never found them again. But the sutra actually says he ran away. So as we tell the story, you can apply it as this metaphor to the situation. The Buddha, the king, as you could imagine, is the Buddha, and the son that gets lost is like us. The Buddha's only children. The Buddha loves so much. But we get lost in the busy marketplace. Or as the sutra says, even more dramatically, I think, we've run away from Buddha. We intentionally have tried to escape Buddha from an early age. I've forgotten all about our noble, wealthy, beneficent parents. So however it is, the child is young enough that he can't speak and he doesn't know how to find his way home and doesn't say exactly what happens. Maybe he was in an orphanage for a little while and people they're usually not the best places to live, so maybe he ran away again. But so he started getting older and he didn't have connections. He was wandering homeless, destitute for many years, just as a beggar. These things do happen. I think there's even a somewhat contemporary movie about an Indian, right? An Indian boy who I think true story, even, who gets lost from his parents somehow and later finds them. Yeah.
Runs away to Australia.
So it's not out of the question that this could have happened. This child loses his parents, wanders off, and becomes destitute and poor. Meanwhile, his parents move to a bigger palace in another town. So even if he had some inkling as he grew up where his home might be, there's no chance of finding it now. But he's wandering for years, for decades. I think it says he's even like in his 30s or something. And across different towns, occasionally looking for odd jobs, mostly not finding them and having to just beg for his food. And he happens by chance, by destiny, by karma, by merit. He happens to wander into the town where his parents are now living in his castle. And as you can imagine, all these years of him being gone, the only child of this royal family, the king and queen are distraught. They've lost their only child. And for a long, long time, they've just longed to find him again. Somehow, maybe we'll find him, but they've almost given up. It's been 30 years or so. But even after all this time has passed, the king, sunbathing on this rooftop of the palace, happens to look down and see this beggar and recognizes him as his son and is shocked and amazed and exalted and exuberant. I can't believe it. My dream has come true. there he is. Quick, he sends his attendants, go down and fetch him and bring him home. And so, meanwhile, the son is down there in the streets, and he's wandered into this kind of like a little bit of a high-class neighborhood. And he's already feeling a little nervous, like, this is not really kind of my kind of place. Other times when I've wandered into this kind of neighborhoods, the cops have just stopped me to even just ask what I'm doing. You know, because I'm all dressed in rags, and they can tell I'm a beggar, and they don't like my type around here. So, actually, maybe I should get out of here. It's not a good place to beg. There's high walls around these houses anyway. But just as he's having this thought and starting to turn around, he sees these spiffy-looking, uniformed attendants running towards him. And he thinks, just as I thought, they're going to get me. And he starts running away. And but they catch him. And he's saying, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm innocent. I'm just leaving anyway. And they're like, no, we have to take you somewhere. Please don't. Please let me go. And they drag him back to the palace. And in terror, the son faints in the palace, thinking he's going to be killed or imprisoned for life. And so the king is so happy to see him. When he hears the story, he thinks, uh-oh, maybe this isn't going to be so easy. In other words, I can't just tell him he's my son. So this is kind of like, we might think that a Buddha could just tell us, you are a child of Buddha. You have everything you need. You have awakened mind. It's complete. Usually it doesn't really work so well, especially at the beginning. It sounds good, but it's like, we might even say if we hear that, that's cool. Now, what's on TV? Or what else? You know, it doesn't impact us, really. So it doesn't really work. It's too sudden. So even though this is the sudden Zen school, we maybe need some like methods to kind of warm up to who we already are. And that's what this Lotus Sutra so beautifully demonstrates. Lotus Sutra is a lot about skillful means, which is devising some sort of methods, a little bit contrived methods to help beings realize who they already are. So this, in this case, the king is like, I need a skillful method here to bring my son back and, you know, have him actually receive my inheritance and rule the palace. It's going to take a little bit of like time and effort here, the king realizes. So this is his method he comes up with. He says, first of all, when he wakes back up from his faint, just release him again, which they do, and he's happy to run away. And then he tells the attendants, maybe some different attendants, don't dress so spiffy. It kind of will scare him away. Put on clothes like he wears, some dirty rags, and go find him again because he's around the area, and tell him you'll hire him for like below minimum wage. If you say above minimum wage, he might be intimidated. So low wages, but you'll actually hire him to do some lowly job like shoveling manure in the palace horse stables. See if he goes for it. So they do, and he says, wow, this is amazing. For him, it's like, I would totally love to shovel manure. That's way a step up from begging, for sure. And minimum wage, I never even thought about that. Anything you can give me, it's fine. And so it kind of works. So he comes in and, in other words, like approaching Buddha, we have to first say, we might even feel like, let's have the vow to become a complete Buddha and save all beings throughout the universe. And I said, no, we can't tell people even about that right away, but we can say, how about just do some like simple, some really simple something, like try to sit still for a few minutes on a cushion, something like that. Okay, we could do that. Don't tell me about Buddha, but I can sit still for a few minutes on a cushion. That's how we start. And I think that this metaphor, this parable of shoveling manure is a great metaphor, because I think this is how we have to start practice. We have to actually, we have a lot of manure. A lot, and as we sit still for a few minutes on the cushion, the manure starts to pile up. Have you noticed? Our stuff, we sometimes call it, our stuff starts to come up. And this is where we have to start. We can't like bypass manure shoveling, sifting through our smelly, dirty stuff. Early on in practice, my teacher suggested to people that they come up with a neurosis inventory. Like you can make like a list. I mean, that's how I actually did it. I still have these lists from like every year. I make this long list of my inventory of neuroses, which is basically like becoming familiar with all our like neurotic habits and tendencies and starting to shovel our manure. We're willing to get in there and look at this stuff. It's because we can't skip that part to become a Buddha. Even though the manure is not really who we are, really, and yet we because it's so entwined with who we think we are, we have to start really looking at it and kind of admitting that we have all these neuroses. Like what kind of things were on my early list? I haven't pulled them out for a while. Things like wanting to be promoted to prime minister, like as soon as possible. I think that might have been on the list. like caring about what other people think about me. Having too much stuff, like being too involved in my stuff, all kinds of things. Thinking I'm not good enough, or thinking I'm better than I am, instead of just being who I actually am. And getting really familiar with all this stuff. So this is the manure shoveling, and the sun is happy to do this in the sutra, and he does it for a while. And he does it well. He's actually pretty devoted to this. It's a step up from his previous lifestyle. And so the king is watching all this from afar, of course, and saying, well, promote him, raise his wages, and it'll give him some confidence. And once in a while, the king is just feels a little bit like, this is so sad. It's just, I know it has to take this long, but it's hard for me. I just want to be with him in the palace. And I know if I can't rush it. So once in a while, the king, just to be intimate with his son, would take off his royal jewelry and put on the rags like the son, dirty himself up, and go in and shovel manure with his son. Cool, huh? I don't know how many kings would be willing to do that, but I mean, this is his son. Maybe most would, knowing it's their true child. He didn't let on who he was, but he got to be close to him that way. And the sutra is nice in the sutra because it goes on for pages and pages of detail here. It's the story really includes a lot of elements. And so it says, sometimes when the king would go down there shoveling with him, the king would say, you're too lazy, you know, work harder. Sometimes the Buddha can talk to his son like that. And sometimes he'd say, you're doing great. You should be promoted. But if you get a little too coasting along, he'd say, don't slack off now. There's a lot of manure to shovel in here. So he keeps getting promoted to stables closer and closer to the palace, maybe. And he's so used to working there and getting to know the people there that at some point they're like, you've been doing this, now you're even leading the manure shovelers of the stable here. We have some other work in the palace where we have some job openings. And so could you actually like come in and do some other jobs? Like eventually he learned to do some like bookkeeping. Now this is getting like into the inner workings of the palace. Like start becoming familiar with the inventory of the king's palace. Like what's actually in there. He never thought that he would be like that, but it was so gradual that at this point he's like, yeah, I can, if you teach me bookkeeping, I can learn it. He does, you know. It's not so shocking, right? The sutra even says that this is 20 years, a 20-year process. And I hear the metaphor, if the dung shoveling is, you know, working through all our karmic patterns and neuroses and becoming familiar with all our greed, hate, and delusion. The bookkeeping is, after we've done that for a long time, the bookkeeping may be a little bit more like starting to hear these more intricate teachings that are, that we, you know, maybe you don't want to learn bookkeeping right off the street, but you're starting to learn about what's in the royal palace here, how it works, you know, what the king, all the king's toys, how the vehicles work, how the dishwasher works, and where they order them from, and how much they cost, and all this kind of stuff. It's like a kind of different kind of work. Bookkeeping. And, you know. At some point he's like helping run the palace. And he gets promoted, so he's now like, basically like, the king, now he knows the king is the king now. And he's like the king's main assistant after 20 years. He knows how the whole thing works. He knows how the palace functions. He's still kind to the manure shovelers and checks in with them periodically. And at some point, the day comes that we've been waiting for, where the king gathers together the whole royal family and all his ministers and advisors. Says, I have a special announcement to make today. And of course, his the son is there too. And he says, my personal assistant here, vice president of the palace or whoever he is, he actually is my son. He's my blood son. And And I'm getting old, and it's time to pass on everything to him. And the whole workings of the palace, leading the whole county, and he knows how to do this stuff now, and it's all his, and it was rightfully his from the beginning. But I couldn't tell him that at first. And at this point, the son is kind of surprised, but not that shocked, really. I'm your son. That is actually amazing that I'm your son. But it actually doesn't make that much difference at this point, because I'm like basically already functioning as your son. The fact that I actually am is not a very big deal. If we're like functioning closer and closer to a bodhisattva or a Buddha, then to hear that we're actually, that's who we really are, maybe not that big a deal. But still, there's this moment in the palace where they're gathered together at a particular time and place, and the king says, "You are my son." And we could say, that's the sudden awakening in our Soto Zen lineage. It's not like a commoner being instantly promoted to prime minister. Mm-hmm. It's after generations of nobility temporarily falling into poverty, but it's a workable situation. And maybe some of us are, you know, can resonate with that kind of thing, especially if we've been practicing for a little while and we think back to the beginning of our practice. Might seem like, yeah, it's different now than it was. And yet it's not different either. Our understanding may be actually different than it was, or the way we relate to practice may be different than it was. And yet, I think I would say that, I don't know how it worked out in the sutra, but I think the work of shoveling manure never ends, actually. That part is the great bodhisattvas still have to do that in one way or another. There still are, you know, we have to keep acknowledging what's appearing and our, you know, how we get caught by false views and misunderstanding of who we really are. We could say the Buddha is like is who we really are, actually, which is our true self is all-inclusive. It's like there's nothing outside of our true self as Buddha. Our true identity is everybody and everything, including this one. We usually don't think that way. And our human, our kind of common human understanding is that myself is just this particular body and these particular thoughts and karmic patterns. It's a very limited self. Our identity seems, you know, it might seem like, well, I can do a lot in my life, but actually compared to the whole universe, to be this body and thoughts and feelings, just these ones, is incredibly limited, right? If that's my true self. So we can say, it's not really that that we go from this limited, singular body and mind self to the boundless self that includes everything. It's not like we suddenly become that prime minister, right? It's more like we've always been that, but we've temporarily forgotten who we are. In the Lankavatara Sutra, another teaching of the Buddha, it says, mind is like an actor on a stage, playing a part. I think that's how we feel. Like, I am this person, Kokyo, that's who I am, and I'm playing this role of Kokyo, and I've been doing it for so long, and people keep telling me that's who I am. From an early age, our parents tell us, you're Kokyo, and this is your body, and this is my body, not yours. And so and we're kind of wired that way. So we, this actor who we think we are, this particular mind, this particular storehouse of all our deluded tendencies and habits, is the Buddha calls like an actor. And, but then we start believing that the part that we're playing is who we really are. The Buddha says this mind or this storehouse of all the tendencies is like an actor, and the projections of mind are like the stage or the set of our environment. So we think that really is the whole environment is just what's happening on the stage, and I, the actor, am who I really am. So we forget that I'm not just this actor, actually. So in my own life, I feel like this development over time, thinking about, well, how does this play out? One way I notice it is actually just in terms of, there's many ways I think this plays out, but one, when I think about it, one is like actually hearing teachings. Like in college, I first started Zen practice, and I took a Zen class in college, and it was like early Chinese Chan. It was a Zen professor. This is my kind of really first ever reading about Zen, and in that class, I probably remember because I still have these like old Xeroxes and ragged books from college of. I read the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. I think Baijan, Huangbo, and Linji records, which are kind of like specific. It wasn't like an intro class. It was kind of specific. And at the time I thought, these are cool. These writings are cool enough to actually get me to want to practice Zazen. But like, I felt like maybe 10% of them I kind of understood, or I thought that I understood what they were talking about. They were so weird, these old Zen things. Very strange. There was something there that got me to practice, but I really, it's a little bit like saying, you're Buddha, and we say, that's cool, I like that idea. But it's like, doesn't impact us very much. It was like, these are cool teachings, but they don't impact me very much, that much. And then maybe, 10 years later, pull off the book off the shelf and open it up, and it's like light is like radiating out of the words. It's like, I read this before? I didn't get it at all before. But now it's like, this is like amazing. It's like talking about my most intimate being. In a clearer way than I could ever express it myself. And then, kind of enjoy those teachings for a while, and then they end up back on the shelf, and then maybe another 10 years later, the same books come off the shelf, and it's like, wow, I remember these in college, and then I remember 10 years later thinking they were really cool too. I have all these notes on them from 10 years later, but now I see them, and I totally didn't understand them 10 years ago. When I thought that I really got them, now I really see that they are like the most precious pieces of paper in the universe. So, which gives one some openness to think that I probably don't really understand them now either. Because 10 years from now, let's pick them up again and see. But all kinds of stuff, without us even noticing, it changes over time. Dogen Zenji, one of our ancestors, says our practice is like walking in the mist, and our clothes gradually get damp, and without noticing it, at some point we're like, I'm totally soaked. But it's not like walking into a sudden downpour. We'll really notice it right away. And maybe we could say that the sudden, if we're talking about it as a sudden school, it's when we suddenly notice that we're totally soaked. But it happened very gradually. So that's some stories about our practice. Do you have any thoughts or questions? Yes. Yeah, ideally we can integrate those realms that the, maybe we'd say in this story, the bookkeeping was about all the affairs of the palace, so it included like where the manure gets sold to, all the contracts with these farms that buy the manure, all the hay that will become the manure, and where that comes from. So it's not like it's totally different things, but it's more like, maybe at first it's just feeling and experiencing the manure as it is with it. We're trying not to resist it, trying to be really open to the manure. But that's not the whole story of our practice, right? We have to actually, at some point, we have to start understanding what the manure is actually made of. Which is like, we might want to wear gloves for that. But if we really want to, become very intimate with what it's made of, it's kind of better not to wear gloves. Just reach in there and check it out. And we can wash our hands afterwards. Yes. Realization that you're where?
That the realization that you are, oh, okay, I'm achieved, or I am this, or I understand, now I know I know I'm there, mm-hmm. Now I know that all this gradual mm-hmm. has gotten me to this place.
Yeah, well, metaphors are always limited by their nature, so I think that you're pointing out a limitation to the Lotus Sutra metaphor, because it's not a position or something like that. It's not the role of being the king, right? It's being Buddha in the metaphor. And if we understand Buddha is in a way the understanding, one way of talking about Buddha is an understanding that there's no separation between self and others. Therefore, self is others and others are self. Or that nothing is what it appears. And maybe early on, at least after some manure shoveling, as he started doing the bookkeeping in the palace, maybe part of the bookkeeping was part of the assessing the riches of this palace was starting to explore this new kind of understanding that things and myself are not what we usually think they are. I'm not limited to this body and mind. I and all beings are spiritual beings that are temporarily having a human experience. Or as even in the early teachings, some story like the Buddha's walking along, kind of glowing, and somebody comes up and says, "Are you like a god or something? Like a celestial being?" And the Buddha says, "No." He says, "Are you a human?" And the Buddha says, "No, I'm not a human." And then, "Well, what are you?" And the Buddha says, "I'm Buddha," which means awake. I'm awake. Or I am the understanding that there's no separation, and I am the actions and the conduct that flow forth naturally from such understanding. So you could say the realization that we've been this all along. At some point, maybe isn't that dramatic. I think if it happens earlier in our practice, these kind of like a sudden shift of understanding, if it happens early in our practice, I think it tends to be more dramatic, because it really is completely different than the way we usually think of ourselves and the world. But if it happens after we've heard a lot of these teachings for a long time and we've done a lot of manure shoveling, then it might be like, yeah, I know I'm not this body, and this is not the world. We'd be like, I really, it's not just an idea, I really see how that is so, but it's not that big a deal. It may be not so dramatic. And I think Soto Zen lineage kind of emphasizes less dramatic, even though it's a sudden school. I think there's virtues in non-drama, in lack of drama. There's virtues in drama because it's good fuel for practice. If we have a little bit of I think that's why the Rinzai Zen lineage, the other Zen lineages, emphasizes the dramatic earlier maybe understanding. And I think it's not like you're finished, but the nice point about the sudden is it gives you a lot of motivation to practice all the time, because you see what's possible. I think that's the danger in not tasting so much directly very soon, because people may be hoping something's going to happen or they'll feel better or something, and then it doesn't really happen very much. So then it's kind of like, well, it happens enough that we can practice a little bit, but it's not like, no, we have to everything has to be overturned here. And it's not enough fuel to keep us practicing that deeply. So I think, so that's why there's virtues, I think, too. Dramatic. But then the drawback to dramatic is then we think we got something and we're done or something like that. But does that make sense how this sudden, which could be either dramatic or non-dramatic, the shift of understanding is actually something much more subtle than being a king, but much better, much greater. Yes.
Going back to the previous thing we're talking about.
Yes.
What do you think the more is in it?
Well, it's made of light.
Okay.
Yeah, which is why it's okay to get it on your hands.
Okay.
Yeah. If we think that it's not made of light, then we probably would not want to refrain from wearing gloves. Yeah, it's made of light, boundless light, and it can't harm us. That's maybe partly why we have to work with all this stuff that's so painful. The manure, I think, is, if it's our, all our karmic patterns and stuff, it's, we usually don't want to shovel it so much because it's painful. We'd rather watch a good movie, wouldn't we? Than like, let's just sit here and like really get into how like selfish I am. Really get into how like I care so much about what other people think, and I always want to get my way, and like just really feel it. It's like, I'd rather watch a movie. But if we get really into it like that, and then start investigating what it's made of, and see, wow, that's such a painful feeling, such a neurotic thought, such an, you know, an ugly thought that this person, I'm trying to be a practitioner, and like, I think that way, but then if we see that thought is made of light, that feeling so painful is made of light, and it can't harm us because it is us. We are light. So that's the, I think, that's one way of looking at why we shovel manure is so, because we don't want to get into some realm of light that it's light, but it's only when things are good. And don't bring in that messy stuff because that might block the light. If there's anything that's not light, then we feel like there's anything that's not made of light, then that's exactly the place where we have to practice. May all positive energy gathered from our assembly tonight be gathered and offered to all beings of light throughout the universe. May all beings thus find their way on the Buddha's long, long path to sudden awakening. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.